Barney Rossett, the bold, risk-taking publisher who shook up the book world in the 1960s and 70s, died Tuesday at age 89. Charles McGrath, in today's New York Times, summarized Rossett's impact perfectly. "He published the books that nobody else would," McGrath wrote, "because they were too risque or avant-garde. Often, that meant the same thing, or too unprofitable. And his imprint, Grove Press, quickly became a badge of coolness and sophistication," unquote. Through his publishing house, Grove Press, and his magazine, The Evergreen Review, Rossett introduced American readers to such writers as Samuel Beckett, Harold Pinter, and Jean Genet, as well as many of the writers of the Beat Generation. He fought two landmark First Amendment battles in order to publish the uncensored versions of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer. He published the autobiography of Malcolm X, Waiting for Godot, The Naked Lunch, and Howl, and imported the sexually provocative Swedish film I Am Curious Yellow. After he sold Grove Press, Barney Rossett continued to run it, then was forced out in a dispute which was settled out of court. Terry Gross interviewed Rossett in 1991, shortly after he launched another publishing company, Blue Moon Press. Terry asked about the first books he put out on Blue Moon, a line of erotic Victorian novels.
Well, that emanated from something I had finally christened at Grove Press as the Victorian Library, which originally started out with Victorian books like Man with the Maid and My Secret Life, and went on from there until we began receiving new manuscripts.
This is Victorian erotica,
yeah,
or pornography.
In a Victorian spirit of that time. And so when I left Grove, I thought the easiest thing for me, the simplest road, was to start again with those books and try to introduce into it gradually contemporary literature.
The titles that you're publishing with Blue Moon are titles like Lustful Memoirs, The Rites of Sodom, Professor Spender, and The Sadistic Impulse, by authors like Anonymous. I mean, some of the books are written by Anonymous. Why is that?
Well, that actually isn't my doing. The Anonymous is quite accurate and true of the Victorian writers. We don't know who wrote My Secret Life, and we don't know who wrote Man with the Maid and a number of other books. But that was sort of a commercial channel that I was routed into, actually, by the chains. I have authors with names, both real and pen names. But I was told by the chains that, no, it was much better to put Anonymous on the books. And and I now think foolishly, I did that. They said, well, that way they can be grouped together. You could see them all. People go in the store and get them. So I did that until the chains were frightened out of buying.
Well, Donald Wildman, one of the conservative Christian lobbyists, and his group had petitioned Walden Books, one of the chains, to remove their books, to remove your
true
books from,
right,
from their stores. Mm-hmm. And they eventually did remove
they
the books.
Did, indeed. In this case, this Reverend Wildman and the American Family Association threatened Kmart that if they didn't stop letting their subsidiary Walden sell specifically our books, they would be boycotted. And the first thing that happened was Walden, Kmart, caved in. I think with a tiny fraction of people, but they did. People say, well, Walden can sell any books they want. Absolutely. I totally agree with that. But the point is, they were selling our books. They were selling them very well. They said so publicly, and then they stopped.
Is this a battle you thought had already been won?
No. I never thought any battle has been won, but it takes different forms. This is one that I think we're singularly unequipped to deal with. I mean, you have to have a constituency, it seems to me, in this kind of a situation. And I don't know where the constituency is in my case. I certainly know where the other constituency is.
What was the first book that you published that ended up getting taken to court over obscenity charges?
Lady Chatterley's Lover, and that was very deliberate, clear idea that actually, we planned a battle plan, which was to get the post office to take action against us as opposed to local government or whatever, so that we could keep it as simple as possible and win or lose at a federal level. And it turned out that way, and we won.
So the Postmaster General accused it of being smutty pornography. What were the grounds that you argued that case in court?
Well, my grounds has always been that anything should be can be published. In this case, judicial or legal wisdom was that it should be argued on the basis that it was a good book and therefore not subject to any kind of censorship. And on that basis, we won very clearly.
The trial, I think, demonstrated that Lady Chatterley's Lover had redeeming literary merit. Did you feel that books should have to prove that they had redeeming literary or social value in order to exist?
No, I certainly don't think so.
And why not?
I think that if you have freedom of speech, you have freedom of speech.
Was there a period in which you or writers and publishers who you knew were testifying about a book's literary and social merits, even if you didn't really like the book very much, but you felt that the book had the right to exist, so you would testify on the grounds that were needed?
Well, I don't think that happened with our books, but what I was really aiming at was publishing Tropic of Cancer, which I had read in 1940 when I was a freshman at Swarthmore College, and it made an enormous impression on me, and I kept it in the back of my mind for many years that someday, somehow, that book would be aired to the rest of the world. So my way of getting to Tropic of Cancer was through Lady Chatterley's Lover.
How did you use Lady Chatterley's Lover to publish Henry Miller's book?
To show that a book of literary merit, whatever, could be published, and go from there to showing that Henry Miller had the same merit. But I felt that it would be more difficult to start with Miller.
Because he didn't
Lawrence.
Have the kind of literary track record
right.
that Lawrence did.
That's right. And it worked out that way.
So how difficult was it to prove for Henry Miller?
Very difficult.
What did you have to do?
There we had hundreds of court cases. Hundreds in one state, 11 in one city. It was a very strange chaos. But ultimately it worked out all right.
What spoke to you about the book? Why did you want to publish it so much?
Well, when I read it, the sex part of it I didn't even notice, which is amazing. To me, it was a tract about the United States, and Miller had a very unusual and cynical viewpoint of modern American life of his time, of the 30s, 40s. I was living in it. Everything he said struck something inside of me, excited me, made me want to be creative and do things like run away from Swarthmore. But other things, I thought it was a marvelous expression of one human being.
An expression of alienation.
Of alienation, I think is a good way to put it. And so I just remember that from 1940 until whenever it was we published in the 60s.
Let's go back to the very beginning when you started to publish. You've told us that you part of how you made your choice of who to publish was who was available, who was already taken. Now, some of the first authors you published are now celebrated authors. Jean Genet, Ionesco, Samuel Beckett. These were, I think, these were the first three authors you published, weren't they?
No, they weren't. The first author I published was Henry James.
Well,
I republished The Golden Bowl of James and another old English novel, The Monk of Matthew Lewis, and eventually worked up to Samuel Beckett and Ionesco and Jean Genet, but it took a few years. These people, though, I had learned about them, I had read things by them, I admired them, And the mainstream, so-called mainstream of American publishing, had bypassed them.
No one wanted to publish Beckett or Genet or Ionesco in the States?
No.
You must have felt really lucky to have a feel to yourself, you know, untouchables who you thought were very, very important.
I certainly did. I certainly felt that exactly that way, that it was very fortunate for me in a certain sense that these people whom I felt were amongst the greatest of the living writers of our time somehow were overlooked by the American establishment.
Publisher Barney Rossett speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. He died Tuesday at age 89.